Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Hello and welcome to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis. I'm Justin Brierley, and this summer we're taking a little break from our regular series with Alistair to bring you some bonus content from other thinkers. The Case for Aslan, Evidence for Jesus in the Land of Narnia, examines how Lewis employed Christian apologetics throughout the fantasy writing of Narnia. And author David Marshall will be talking to me today about how in The Silver Chair, Puddleglum proves himself to be a wise, if gloomy, thinker. There's a link to the book from today's show. If you want more from the podcast and to register there for bonus content, you can find a free ebook and all our regular updates by getting hold of our newsletter at our website, premierunbelievable.com. Also links from today's show to our upcoming webinar, Tuesday the 13th of September, Falling from Grace, addressing leadership, abuse and power, with a special panel including Amy Orr Ewing, Mike Cosper, Rachel Den Hollander and Diane Langberg. You can attend free from anywhere in the world online. Just register in advance at unbelievable.live. Right now, here's part one of my conversation with David Marshall. Hello, welcome along to today's show. And in the first of a few episodes, I'm joined today on the podcast by David Marshall, who's author of a new book, The Case for Aslan, Evidence for Jesus in the Land of Narnia. It's just been released. And it's in a way, it's an apologetics book, but it's based on Narnia. It brings to the surface lots of the ways in which Lewis made the case for faith, but often perhaps amissed in the stories of Narnia. I've had real fun reading it. And David is evidently someone who knows not just Narnia, but C.S. Lewis through and through. So David, welcome along to the show.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here.
It's great to have you. When did your journey with Lewis and Narnia start yourself, David?
Well, I suppose I could date it to a glacial valley in Alaska called Mendenhall Valley. After church, one day, our family went to some friend's house, and my parents were talking with our friends upstairs, and I got bored with the adult conversation. So I went downstairs and started rummaging through the books in the father's den. And I came across some C.S. Lewis books. That was when I was in eighth grade. And I've been reading C.S. Lewis ever since. And he's a lot of the books in the background here, they were recommended to me by C.S. Lewis himself. So he's furnished the,
I assume by that, you don't mean you met him and he recommended them, but through his books, they've been recommended to you.
There's no better way to figure out what books you're going to read than read C.S. Lewis's letters and note what he was reading at different stages of his life and sort through some of those books and find ones you enjoy. It's a great way to introduce yourself to the world of letters.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, he was a prolific letter writer just as much as he was a writer of literature and fantasy and everything else. And yeah, it's well worth your time if you like your Lewis. Okay, so Narnia then sort of, I guess, was with you from that kind of age. Did you kind of immediately see the Christian allegories and so on going on? Not everyone who comes to Narnia necessarily sees that, maybe until adult years, you know?
Well, I was raised in a Christian family, so it was pretty obvious, I suppose. Also, I began reading Lewis's other works, and I was deeply influenced by, for example, the Near Christianity. And I guess what Aslan says about himself to Lucy is at one point she asks, you know, he says something like, the older you get, the bigger I will become. And Lucy assumes, well, it's the other way around. Normally you go, you grow up and you get older and things become smaller. Like I was taking my son to a lake that we'd visited many years ago, a few days ago. And wow, this lake isn't as big as I remember it as being.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the case of Aslan keeps on getting larger as you grow older. And for me, that's been very much the case. As I've gotten to know the world better, and first of all, going off to college, and secondly, going to Asia as a missionary, which meant I was trying to figure out if God was really there. To be honest, I was supposed to be a missionary for Youth with a Mission, but I was really wondering if this business about God could possibly be true. And so encountering all the things you encounter in a place like Asia, you know, different religions, girls who've been forced into prostitution, people who disagreed with you from a materialist point of view, all the atheism and the communism in communist China, where I spent a lot of time. I found a lot of challenges to the Christian faith, but somehow what I met of Christ through Aslan as a young man also seemed to grow as I went along, as I started to encounter some of these challenges.
Yeah. And over time, you know, you've used all those experiences to develop, I think, a very cogent case for Christianity. You've published a number of books in defense of the historical Jesus, in defense of Christianity generally, responding to new atheism. You've been on my Unbelievable show several times, either talking about or debating with others. Perhaps we'll come to that later, because John Loftus, you had quite the memorable debate with several years ago. But in a way, has alongside the apologetics, in a sense, Lewis, in a sense, Narnia was his imaginative side coming out. In fact, I think some biographers, A.N. Wilson, I think, claims that really Lewis started writing fantasy literature in his later years because he kind of gave up on apologetics, which was, you know, his earlier endeavor. And I think Wilson pinpoints this to him getting a bit of a drubbing from Elizabeth Anscombe in a debate of the Socratic Society. So what's your view on that? Does Lewis sort of retreat into fiction after kind of, you know, getting disillusioned with apologetics?
Well, there are people who have taken Wilson on in regard to the particular facts of that argument. For example, one could point out, and many have, that after that debate, Lewis did in fact engage in a lot of apologetic arguments. His, what I regard as a wonderful essay, Fernseed and Elephants, was written about the same time as the Chronicles of Narnia, as a matter of fact. And from my point of view, having studied a lot of the skeptical challenges to the Gospels, particularly the Jesus Seminar in the United States, and people like Bart Ehrman and other people who have challenged the truth of the Gospels, I think that C.S. Lewis's Fernseed and Elephants still remains, it anticipated a lot of the arguments that people would make later on and overthrew them. I think undermined and disproved a lot of the arguments against the Gospels that would come decades after he was born, after C.S. Lewis passed away. Sorry, what was the question again?
Well, whether he did actually, you know, give up on apologetics. It sounds like you're saying no, he didn't, even though he obviously turned towards the imagination more with Narnia and so on.
I'm saying that on the historical level, you could say, no, he didn't turn away from apologetics because he still wrote a lot of articles that were apologetic in nature. But of course, the thesis of this book is that Lewis also included a lot of apologetics within his imaginative writing. And the arguments that he makes in those writings not only make sense from his point of view and show that he still has rational reasons for believing in Christ, and that he wants to make those arguments, but that those arguments have grown like Aslan in the subsequent decades since Lewis passed away, that those arguments have become even stronger, looked at from the perspective of later research and my own fields of research, and also other areas of apologetics and checking the truth of the Gospels from different perspectives. As for the particular claim that A.N. Wilson made, and he actually made it in regard to poor Puddleglum, the marsh wiggle. And for those of, I imagine that most of your listeners know who Puddleglum is.
Well, whenever I think of Puddleglum, I think of the BBC version of the Chronicles of Narnia. And I think it was played by Tom Baker, and it's sort of etched in my memory as a wonderful depiction of this, you know, this very glum marshwiggle.
I haven't had the pleasure of seeing that. I have been compared to Puddleglum at times.
Oh, well,
which I consider an honor.
I think that's a good comparison, in as much as Puddleglum, you know, he may be obviously on the more melancholy side, but at the end of the day, he's the hero of the story, isn't he? He's the hero of the hour. And I love the way you begin with Puddleglum and tell me why you introduced the book with Puddleglum's wager. And obviously there are overtones of Pascal's wager in that.
Yes. Title. Let me give the Anne Wilson quote. After he quotes Puddleglum, he says, "The wounded Christian, unable to think out his position, but determined in a moving and dogged way to be loyal to it." So Anne Wilson's point is that Puddleglum represents blind faith, that Puddleglum represents holding to your faith like a dog holding to its bone, just because you want to believe it. But actually, I don't think that's what Puddleglum is doing at all. In fact, I argue that, well, we have the word epistemology in English, which derives from the word pisteo in Greek, to believe, beginning with the letter P. So I talk about four great philosophers whose names begin with the letter P, who all talked about why we believe things, why it's wise to believe some things and unwise to believe other things, how, in fact, we can determine what is true and what is false. And that's the question that confronts Puddleglum and his comrades, really, in the prince and Jill and Eustace in the underworld, when they're trying to escape from underworld and they encounter a witch. I don't know if I should tell the story or not, for people who are familiar with the story. Maybe mention a little bit of it in a second. But let me talk about maybe better set the scene a little bit with that. So three comrades, Puddleglum and the two children from our world, have gone on search of the lost prince Rillian, and they find him underneath Aslan. The noble lion gives them several signs that they must follow in order to find the prince. The third of the signs is a sign. They will meet a message in a ruined city that says that they will tell them what to do, and they must follow those directions. Well, they come to the ruined city. They don't stop. But later on, they look out and they see the sign, the words "under me" inscribed in huge letters across the ruined city of the giants. And so they realize that what they must do is they must somehow get underneath this ruined city. And that way they'll be able to find the lost prince. So they travel, they escape from another group of giants. They travel underneath the ruined city of the lost giants. And then they find themselves in underworld, which is a dark, gloomy continent underneath the ground, thousands of miles beneath the surface of the earth, which the only inhabitants seem to be a very gloomy group of people called gnomes. The gnomes never laugh, they never talk, they never smile. And they take them prisoner, and they take them to a city of the gnomes, and it's a very quiet city because the gnomes never talk. When they arrive at the city, they meet the queen of this underworld, who is variously called the green emerald queen, or they have different names for her. She's also described as a witch. And she is the one who has enchanted Prince Rillium, whom they meet in this ruined city. They set Prince Rillium free, and just as they do so, the queen arrives, and she's very angry. She takes some magic potion and she tosses these chemicals onto the fire near in the palace where they're at, and then she begins strumming an instrument like a mandolin, according to Lewis. That's the way he describes the instrument. He doesn't tell exactly what the instrument is. Now, before they went on their quest, the children went on their quest for the lost prince, Aslan had instructed them with these four signs that they must follow. And then he said, when you go down into the world of Narnia, your mind will become foggy. The air is thicker down there. So you must be very careful. This is the context in which the four travelers and the queen engage in a debate. And here you are in a children's novel. And in the children's novel, you're underneath the ground thousands of feet in some subterranean cavern, and you encounter a witch. So naturally, what you're going to do is debate epistemology, have a philosophical debate. And the lead debater on the traveler side is the Marshmuggle Puddleglum. Now I describe him. I say that he's similar. There are four philosophers whose names begin with the letter P, who have all thought deeply about the question of why we should believe things or not believe things. First one is Plato. Mm-hmm. Plato also talked about a cave. Plato's cave is probably the most famous analogy that he made. Plato said that we're all trapped in a cave. Mm. And we don't know the way out of that cave. And he described us as slaves who only see images on the wall of the cave, which are not the original object themselves. We can only see them. It's very dark. So the situation is very similar, actually, to C.S. Lewis's cave. The underworld is very similar to Plato's cave. The second great thinker that I compare Puddleglum to is the French philosopher Blaise Pascal. Now, when you say the name Pascal, everybody immediately thinks of Pascal's wager. And what do we know about Pascal's wager? What do people think of when they think of Pascal's
wager? Well, that usually when I bump into people, they think it's a bit silly, because the way they cast it, at least, is you might as well believe in God just in case he does exist, in which case you'll get to heaven if he does, but you won't have lost anything if he doesn't. And I can understand why people would think, well, that doesn't sound like a great argument for believing in God. It's a basically hedge my bets kind of argument. And can you even believe in something just on the basis that it might be true? Therefore, you're going to just, you know, play it safe. So that's the popular level understanding, if you will.
Well, the scary thing about the popular level understanding of Pascal's wager is just how popular it actually is. If you read Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, you'll find that version of it there as well. If you read even some professional philosophers, when they talk about Pascal's wager, even some Christian philosophers, when they talk about Pascal's wager, that's what they'll have in mind. They'll say, well, okay, Pascal was a gambler. He was a numbers man. Okay, so we have to gamble on our lives. We only have one life. What are we going to do with our life? We can't say no. We can't say no to this choice that we have to make. Are we going to believe in God, or are we not going to believe in God? There's no evidence either way, or the evidence is even, or maybe the evidence is even against Christianity, according to Richard Dawkins. That's his interpretation of Pascal. So we have to balance that against the rewards of believing, or against the penalties of not believing. And if we believe in God, even if the evidence is against it, maybe there's a 100-to-1 chance. Still, that one chance, we might wind up going to heaven. So the payoff is huge compared to the payoff of falsely believing, even if you believe that there is no God, and there is no God, well, nothing is lost.
You don't lose anything. Yeah.
You don't lose anything. That's the popular version of Pascal's wager. But there seems to be an iron law of exegesis, and that is everyone who talks about Pascal. Let me put it this way. No one who talks about Pascal on the internet has ever read him.
I know what you mean. I mean, when you go and read Pascal, he's a brilliant thinker. I mean, if all you know of Pascal is that popular level sort of, pastiche of his wager, then you're really missing out. Because as you say, there's a treasure trove of stuff there, isn't there?
Well, it's not only the treasure chest, they're particularly addressed to this particular challenge to the Pascal's wager is the end of Pensée, chapter after chapter, talks about three particular kinds of evidence for the Christian faith. So he doesn't say that there's an even 50-50 chance that Christianity is true. In fact, he's saying, very much like Aslan said, he's warning us, when you go down into this thick atmosphere of the world of Narnia, or maybe in the underworld, when the witch tosses the chemicals onto the fire, your brain is going to become fogged. Now, I know you guys have had had a heat wave back in the UK.
Yeah, we have.
It's getting kind of hot here too, and I can kind of understand that, how the brain tends to fog under certain environmental circumstances. So Pascal's wager was actually Pascal's wager was actually very similar in a way to Puddleglum's wager, because Puddleglum basically says, maybe you're right about everything you've said, witch. Maybe this world is all that there is. Maybe the cat, maybe the lion Aslan is actually just an amplification of your cat. And maybe the sun is just like this lamp that's hanging. There can't possibly exist a sun. Mm. Maybe there is no sun. Maybe there is no Aslan. Maybe there is no overworld, no Narnia. Maybe I've only imagined all of this. But still, it's quite interesting. It's quite amazing that four children playing a game, as you say, have managed to create a world that licks your world hollow. This is actually a rational argument, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, first of all, of course, the four travelers had actually been to Narnia. And even if their memory of it wasn't very strong, they did have certain memory. Mm-hmm. And you also kind of have a multiplicity of testimony, too, which also comes into the Gospels pretty well. You have four different people who all say, yes, I've been to this place called Narnia. Maybe their memories are not very strong of it, but there is some, from a certain perspective, there is some evidence for that. Mm. But more importantly, from C.S. Lewis's point of view, he's saying he compares this to the ontological argument, and he credits Anselm and Locke, I believe, for earlier versions of the ontological argument. But his basic point is this. This is really beyond this world that you claim that we invented is beyond our capacity to invent. It's something that we would never have thought of. We never could have thought of. In another one of his books, he compares us to fish swimming in the ocean who don't know that there is water because we're swimming in the water. Well, from that point of view, from Lewis's point, and this, whether this is a good argument or not a good argument really isn't the point at this point. The point is that Lewis is not just giving up. He's not just believing in blind faith, but he's making an argument that's based on our experience in the world.
Mm. It's a great way to begin. And I love the way that you kind of put that out there at the beginning, that whole idea of, you know, well, as Puddleglum puts it, you know, perhaps that world doesn't exist, but if it it's a better world, a world that these children have imagined turns out to be a better world than the world you're living in. And yes, and there's almost,
there is an element of the popular conception of Pascal's wager there too, saying, this is a better investment, you know?
Yeah.
I'd rather die searching for this better world than live in your pit of a kingdom, which C.S. Lewis had experience of in his own search for truth as a young man.
Well, we'll come back to this in the next episode of the show. And of course, it's Puddleglum in the end who sort of saves the day by stamping out the fire with the witch's, you know, heady mixture that's sort of influencing the travelers and helps the party to escape. And
not at all an enchanting smell, burnt marsh wiggle.
Indeed. We're going to talk about on the next episode, Susan, who is you know, a figure of controversy sometimes in the Narnia stories because of the way that Lewis sort of ends the stories and her particular story. So we're going to come to her on next week's show. But can I recommend you go and get a copy of The Case for Aslan by David Marshall? It's linked with today's show, and it's a really excellent guide, not only to Lewis and to Narnia, but to the way in which you can dig out some really great apologetic gems from the works of Lewis and Narnia in particular. So he's my guest today on the show, David Marshall, and next week as well. Do come back again, and I'll see you then.
Well, thank you for being with me on the show today. We'll be continuing the conversation next week with David. We need to talk about Susan. Authors such as Philip Pullman and J.K. Rowling weren't happy with the way Lewis handled her story at the end of the Narnia Chronicles. Well, David will be defending it. Thanks for being with us. Do check out all the other good stuff on offer from PremierUnbelievable.com, including this show and, of course, our upcoming webinar in September. For now, God bless and see you next time.